This show is created for adult audiences only. Our show notes include content warnings and other helpful information. We strongly recommend taking a moment to assess the situation before continuing. Let's begin.
Episode 136, The Disappearance of Stephen Kocher. In the chilling stillness that so often clung to the outskirts of Henderson, Nevada, the story of Stephen Kocher unfolded like a grim novella, penned by fate itself. It was December 12, 2009, when this 30-year-old man from the tranquil streets of St. George, Utah, stepped into a narrative so perplexing, it could very well have been the brainchild of a macabre author's imagination. Stephen was the embodiment of the boy next door, devout in his faith, immaculately clean-cut, and untouched by the shadows of the law. A figure seemingly plucked from the heart of Americana, making his disappearance not just a mystery, but a stark deviation from the expected course of his life. As he ventured into the arid embrace of Nevada, it was as though he crossed an invisible threshold, leaving the ordinary world behind, and stepping into a realm where anything could happen. Beneath the surface of Stephen's unblemished exterior, however, ran currents of distress. The specters of financial woes haunted him. Unemployment had taken its toll, leaving him adrift in a sea of overdue rent and scant income. His only lifeline appeared to be a part-time endeavor, distributing flyers for a window washing company in Utah. Yet, those who knew Stephen saw no shadow upon his demeanor. His spirit seemed unbroken by his monetary struggles. The journey to Nevada, a tapestry woven from whimsy and despair, remained a mystery. On the surface, it was a quest peppered with mundane intentions. Christmas shopping, a visit to a friend that never came to be, and fleeting moments shared with the welcoming family. But beneath these seemingly innocuous activities lurked questions that no one could answer. Why Nevada? Why then? His pilgrimage was punctuated by a conversation on his cell phone, voices in the ether that provided no clues, leaving his true purpose in question. The saga of Stephen Kocher took a more sinister turn with the discovery of his car, abandoned in an eerie stillness of a dead-end cul-de-sac in Henderson. This place, a quiet enclave designed for the twilight years of life, where residents over the age of 55 found solace in retirement's embrace, suddenly became the backdrop to a mystery as dense and impenetrable as the fog that rolls in from the desert at night. When the Kocher family was informed about the vehicle, abandoned and silent, a cold dread gripped them, an unshakable conviction that the fabric of their reality was about to be shaken around them. Stephen was declared missing, vanishing into the ether with only his car left behind, a silent sentinel in this quiet neighborhood. Inside, the remnants of his life were strewn about, a poignant tableau of normalcy with a gaping void where his phone, wallet, and keys should have been. The plot thickened with the emergence of surveillance footage, a silent witness to Stephen's last known moments. The video, gleaned from a homeowner's security system, captured a fleeting glimpse of Stephen's white Chevrolet Cavalier, as it sought its final resting place at the street's end. Moments later, the lens caught the image of Stephen, a solitary figure moving with purpose, clutching a folder or some indistinct item. His presence marking the timestamp of his own mystery at noon on December 12th. Like a ghost, he passed by, never to retrace his steps to the car, never to be seen again in the realm of the living. Shortly after Stephen Kocher's disappearance, detectives delved into the digital echoes left by his cell phone in the 48 hours, following the moment he was captured on security footage. Yet far from shedding light on his whereabouts, the information unearthed only deepened the mystery. The cell phone data, as provided by his carrier, revealed three distinct GPS signals that seemed to chart a northward course, away from where his car was abandoned. The initial signal was detected at the crossroads of Arroyo Grande Boulevard and American Pacific Drive, a mere 5 hours after Stephen was last observed, positioning him 10 miles northeast of his vehicle's location. Then, 2 hours later, around 7 p.m., the digital trail picked up again, this time just 2 miles further north in the Whitney Ranch area. The last known ping from Stephen's phone was recorded the morning of December 13th, near the juncture of U.S. Route 93 and Russell Road, where the signal lingered near this last location for the following 2 days before fading into silence. During this interval, Stephen's phone displayed activity, such as opening a text from his landlord and accessing voicemail, until the presumed depletion of the battery. Regrettably, the lack of surveillance cameras at these key locations left an impenetrable void regarding whether Stephen was on foot or had found transportation during these movements. A deeper analysis, intertwining his phone's GPS data with bank records and conversations had prior to his vanishing, indicated that Stephen had traversed the distance between Utah and Nevada multiple times. The path he chose appeared haphazard, imbued with a randomness that baffled investigators. Given the financial duress Stephen was under, it speculated that the remnants of his finances were likely consumed by fuel for these excursions. It was estimated that, in the lead-up to his disappearance, Stephen had covered over 1,100 miles in his travels. Inquiries into Stephen's purported destinations revealed a pattern of evasiveness. His explanation shifted depending on the inquirer. On one journey, he visited an ex-girlfriend's home, dining with her family in her absence under the pretense of heading to Sacramento to see relatives. Conversely, to his own mother, he spoke of a job interview for a position he had pursued, a claim later found to be unsubstantiated. This chilling tale captured the imagination of the nation, finding its way into the annals of the true crime show Disappeared, where it was laid bare for all to see, a puzzle with pieces lost to time. Online in the shadowy corners of forums like Reddit, theories abounded. Each attempt at unraveling the mystery, only serving to weave it tighter. Stephen Kocher's story, a narrative woven from the very threads of uncertainty and fear, remains an open book. Its final chapters, eternally unwritten in the annals of the unknown. Thus, the question persists, whispering from the shadows. What could have transpired? In the vast echoing silence that surrounds the vanished, speculation is a siren song that calls to us, tempting with its promise of answers. Yet in the curious saga of Stephen Kocher, the layers of mystery run deep, each more complex than the last. Financial duress painted the backdrop of his life, suggesting a journey born of necessity might have beckoned, Despite the shadow of his unexplained voyage, his interactions betrayed no hint of the turmoil that lay beneath. His path, marked by the digital footprints of cell pings and bank transactions, wove a tapestry of randomness, a destination known only to him, leaving us grasping at the threads of motive and purpose. His digital world, explored through laptop and living space, remained a silent witness, offering no clues to the puzzle. What little knowledge we possess is but a drop in the ocean of uncertainty. The digital whispers of a cell phone and computer shed no light on the reason of his journey, why it ended in that tranquil housing development. His vehicle, found abandoned, stands as a stark monument to his disappearance, with the fleeting capture on a security camera offering a tantalizing glimpse of his final hours. This visual echo raises more questions than it answers. The narrative of his cell phone, a beacon in the night, hints at a journey continued beyond his disappearance. Tracing a path from south to northeast, its signal flutters like a candle in the wind, casting shadows and illuminating little. The checking of voicemail in the pre-dawn silence, the lingering presence in Henderson's embrace, all culminate in a signal extinguished. Was Steven the architect of this journey? Or had his phone embarked on a path of its own? Thus, we find ourselves contemplating the story of a man, his life a tapestry of ordinary struggles, who steps into the unknown and vanishes. The specter of a sinister meeting, conjured from the depths of the digital ether, fails to hold weight under scrutiny. The absence of an electronic trail to Vegas, the improbability of a clandestine job interview orchestrated in such a manner, these pieces do not fit the puzzle of Steven's disappearance. Perhaps Henderson was but a way station on a journey undefined, a stop in a quest both personal and professional. The idyllic setting, ripe for the business of a man armed with flyers and hope, offers a poignant backdrop to what might have been the beginning or end of a plan. Yet the true nature of his intentions, like the man himself, remains lost to us. The silence of the community, the absence of eyewitnesses, suggest a swift deviation from the visible paths. In a place where the rhythm of his life is often watched by many, Stephen's passage went unnoticed, hinting at an encounter that swiftly diverted his course. Theories abound, suggesting engagements turned dark, opportunities twisted into traps. In the end, some believe a meeting, veiled in the guise of opportunity, may have ensnared Stephen shortly after his arrival. A narrative unfolds, a tale of desperation, of a conversation turned nefarious, of a path that led him far from the safety of the known into the shadowy realms of conjecture. Whether his disappearance was woven into the dark tapestry of the drug trade or a different web of circumstance, the belief persists that Steven Kocher's story ended far from where it began, carried away by currents unseen and forces unknown. Welcome, campers, to Campfire Tales of the Strange and Unsettling. We're your hosts. I'm Ryan.
And I'm Jordan. And now the debrief.
It's good to hear your voice.
Yeah, I'm here. We should probably address this.
I mean, yeah, because there's a giant elephant in the room.
Yeah.
At the moment.
Why am I always the giant elephant in the room? So the last two Fridays I've been absent. My wife and I recently bought a house, and we're in the process of remodeling it. And so things have been insane here, going back and forth, scheduling things. I also started doing some work on the side and like banker's hours, basically, which I'm not used to at all. So it's definitely been, I'm like in an adjustment period.
right now and trying to figure out how to make it all work. So that's why I've missed the last two Friday episodes.
It's all right. I mean, you know.
But yeah, I'm working on it. I don't plan on missing any more episodes. So
all right.
I will be here for this Friday's Camp Divination.
Well, if not, I think we've made the decision that to just, you know, do away with you for the show.
Yeah, just move forward.
We're giving one more chance. That's the final one.
I mean, like, strike three and you're out, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
That's fair. I get it.
Yeah, exactly. With that said,
you want to talk about this coacher fella?
Speaking of baseball.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Stephen Coacher. Yeah, this is a strange one just because, I mean, if you just follow the story, it's almost as if this dude literally just vanished. Yeah.
I remember I vaguely remember a quote with his mom or one of his family members said something to the effect of like, the story reads as if he was walking down the street and just vanished, but we know that doesn't actually happen.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you take the story for what it is, also the security footage and everything that sees him literally walking down the road and disappearing out of view as he like basically walks up to this house.
Yeah.
And then it's just that's the last anybody's ever seen of him.
I have to imagine they spoke with the person who owned that house.
They did. And we'll definitely we'll dive into this. Because a lot of this a lot of this was more so like it wasn't 100% that he actually went to this house. It kind of like looked like it most likely did, but it was eventually determined that he did. And so, I mean, we have a lot of theories. We have a lot of information, and then there's some information in 2020 that was finally released to the public. It was like some odd 100 and some pages.
Wow.
That became public record at that point. There is still some redacted information, but you know, we have a lot more now, and it's kind of changed my whole thought on everything.
Okay.
So
interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So just, I mean, you know, obviously we'll kind of start, I say we start by talking, let's talk
always
about
established details.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there was one, you know, one big thing was, which we kind of talked about as we were about to get into this. You know, there was mention of him making a lot of different trips and things like that before he actually went to the Vegas area. And it was said that, I mean, after, you know, going through the GPS locations from his phone, matching that with bank records and also the conversations that he had with people along the way.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, puts him literally traveling over 1,100 miles.
Yeah.
From Utah to Nevada.
Yeah.
And it's pretty crazy.
It is. It's weird. And this was completely out of the norm for him. He wasn't someone who took crazy trips. This is like, he's like a true blue Utah Mormon.
Right.
Like, ultimate nice guy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and the fact that he had lost his job, you know, I mean, he's struggling to make ends meet. He has little to no money right now that he's living on, but yet he's spending all the money he does have
to drive
making these trips.
Yeah, it's weird. It's definitely weird.
Very weird.
It reads very sketchy to me.
It seems like it, right?
Because someone who's broke doesn't travel that much. That frequently, because he was going like what with like a day in between, 2 days in between, he made several trips in a row.
Yeah,
where he'd be gone all day. He didn't tell anyone and anyone in his family where he was going. Nothing. And someone who's broke doesn't do that unless it's for money.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Now he did. His mom did question him, you know, like where he was going, and he claimed to be going to Nevada. I think it was some specific place or somewhere in Nevada for a job interview for an application he had submitted, which, I mean, checked out. Like when his car was found, it was found with a lot of applications.
Yeah.
Like job applications, a lot of the flyers, because he also did kind of like a part-time gig for like a window cleaning business where he just hand-to-hand...
Passed out flyers.
Handed out flyers, which, that sucks. That reminds me of being in high school and handing out flyers for shows.
Yep.
You know, so, I mean, yeah, there's that, and then, you know, but, again, he did have a lot of different applications and stuff. So, I mean, maybe we can buy that. Maybe one of his trips was for that.
Sure.
But
there was some... There was some weird shit, like one of the farthest trips, the only place they actually figured out where he went was to the Kmart, where he bought a baby bib.
He had bought some something Christmas else that presents.
That they assumed were Christmas presents.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a long way to go to a Kmart. You right. know what I mean? Like, they yeah. don't know anywhere else he went.
Yeah, I mean, it seems very out of character for him.
Uh-huh.
And then there was also the bit with him going to... another area in Nevada for an old girlfriend, an old girlfriend's house. And she wasn't even home, but he had lunch with her family.
Yeah.
And told them that he was going to visit family in Sacramento, which wasn't true.
Yeah. The girlfriend's family was even like, they even found it kind of awkward.
Right.
Like, cause they're like, she's not here. And he still stayed and ate lunch with them.
I don't know. I've never done that with an ex's family.
Nope. I've had exes do it with my family, but I've never done it.
Yeah, well, yeah, same. You know, but yeah, it's weird. Like that like jumped out at me as just really, really strange. It's almost like trying to establish an alibi of some sort.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Like, he just needed, like, who's someone I know near here.
Right. And they can vouch, and he told him he was going to visit family in Sacramento. He's planned out, like, this whole story.
Yeah.
And then he's, like, packing on the miles on his car. Maybe he did, you know, like...
Yeah.
But...
Okay, because in these situations, these missing persons cases where the person just lost a job or their life's taken some crazy downturn,
mm-hmm.
I instantly go Occam's razor and like they went and committed suicide. So
I mean, I try not to be that, like that be the first thing that I think, but maybe.
I mean, that's just where my brain goes instantly in those cases. Cause it happens so frequently, like somebody's life falls apart and instead of, like doing it at home where a family member is going to find you or something, people go off in the woods or they drive out into the desert, something like that, and do it.
Yeah.
But all these trips beforehand, that doesn't make any sense for that.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't line up with that. It points to something a little more nefarious.
Right. Yeah. Agreed. And then we have him going into the Vegas area. And he even gets a call like from someone at the church that asks him to run either like a Sunday school or some like either like preach or something. I can't remember exactly, but you know, he had told him like he was out of town, but he would try and, you know, try and make it back to be able to do so.
Yeah.
So there were like all these things that also suggested he was supposed to be coming back.
Yep.
And this trip wasn't going to take very long. Like,
there was also, though, he was experiencing or he had an upswing on the horizon because his bishop went on record saying that he had told him that he was going to have an opening for him at the first of the year. Like, because he had been struggling financially, as we've established, like working this really shitty part-time job to try and make ends meet and it wasn't cutting it. But things were about to get better.
Mm-hmm.
They were gonna hire him to work for the church. But then he just sort of vanishes.
Right.
It's odd. Very odd.
That was something that like his family, when it came down to like everything in the end, like his family still believed that he was, you know, he was gonna be coming back home. He was excited, you know, he had this job opportunity coming up, like, you know, like he wasn't in as bad of a place as like all of these different theories in the story kind of suggests.
Yeah.
But they think that he did indeed go for another job interview that morning. And because, I mean, even in the footage, the security footage shows him like dressed neatly, you know, and he's walking with like either a folder or a briefcase. We can't really 100% tell. Yeah. But they said, like, dude, like, you can tell that he, like, is walking with a purpose. Like, he knows where he's going. Yeah. He knows what he's doing. You know, he knows where he's at. And then, yeah, and then we have,
He doesn't look all confused or disoriented. He doesn't look, like, scattered or nervous about anything. It looks like a guy getting out to walk in for a job interview.
Yeah.
Like, that's what it looks like.
Yeah, so he's not, like, running. He's not, you know, I mean, he knows. He's obviously, I mean, this footage shows him arriving at 11:54 and then walking, you know, across the road at 12 o'clock.
Yeah.
And so...
Which, I've heard some people characterize it like he sat in his car for a long time before he got out. But, like, 6 minutes is, that's, like, enough time. Especially, like, imagine you pull up for a job interview, right?
Yeah.
And you know, it's normal to sit there and, like, kind of psych yourself up a little, get your thoughts in order, get completely prepared, and then you take off.
Absolutely.
Right? And 6 minutes isn't a long time for that.
No, not at all. I mean, no, that
totally normal.
That would be me, you know, like amping myself up, like, oh, yeah, another job interview. Let's go. You know, so I mean, yeah, I find nothing out of the ordinary for that to be the case. But that seems to be a focal point for a lot of people, like focusing on that time that he spends just waiting.
Yeah.
And I had found someone else that dove a little bit deeper into that, stating that when they took pictures of his car, you know, I mean, it had all of his stuff still in his applications, everything minus his, like, wallet, his keys, and his phone.
Yeah.
But, like, on the dash, he had, like, all these flyers strewn about of for that business, you know.
Yeah.
Which a lot of people thought that was weird, that he had him on his, you know, had him on his, like, dash in the window or whatever. Which maybe, like, you know, maybe he was trying to get this folder or his briefcase or something, so he, like, stuck a stack up there and, you know, got it out from underneath or something.
Slid across as he was driving.
Right.
Yeah.
But, yeah, anything, I mean, everything about this, and he also had a half a tank of gas still in the tank. Like,
yeah.
Everything about it suggested that he was going to be back that night to go back to the church. He was going to be coming, you know, going to his family's for Christmas, like something they had been planning. And he would, like, his mom, like, talked that he was very excited about doing. And so, you know,
now I have
just seems strange.
I did notice a lot of that from the family, particularly the mother, like, and the other people who spoke to him in the final days before he disappeared. They all seem to, like, there's no way he killed himself. There's no way he disappeared on purpose because he was in such high spirits.
Yeah.
He was in such a, he had such a positive attitude.
Right. It's easy to put on a face though, or put on a show.
Also, what people don't realize is for people who have had like thoughts of suicide for a long time, usually once they've decided they're going to do it, you know, they're fully committed now. They've decided that that's the solution, right? That they're just going to do it.
It's the means to an end.
Then that last period between when they decide they're going to do it and when they finally do it, they're in high spirits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're happy, like, because they have, to them, they've found the solution, right? And that's why you so often in situations with suicide, you hear people say, like, I don't understand, he seemed to be doing so well,
right?
Like, he was so much better, and then it happens, and it's because they're, you know, they're suffering, and then they figure out, this is how I'm going to handle it.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's that's weird, true, to think about that, to try and put yourself in that headspace, but, like, that's really how it goes a lot of times. Yeah,
that's true too. Another thing that his family, like, another reason they didn't feel that a lot of this was out of place, and his, like, random travels and the, you know, like, that the miles he was kind of putting out on there basically up until this point, they said it wasn't particularly unusual because one of his reasons for moving to St. George, which is where he was living at the time, one of the reasons was to be able to research family history in the area.
Okay.
And he often went on tours of cemeteries looking for ancestors' graves and things like that. And his mother believed that his trips were basically just his way of keeping himself busy despite his unemployment.
Right.
You know, which...
I could see that, sinking into your hobbies when you're between jobs, right?
Yeah, we're looking for something to do. Like,
that much driving is expensive for a broke guy.
It is. It's really expensive, unless he knew he had something coming up, so he was like, all right, you know, I've got this on the horizon, so
yeah,
not overly fair. Worried about it. Or he didn't have much to, you know, much going for, you know, to live for left.
Yes.
So might as well get it all out, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it depends on how you look at it.
Right. It works either way. But like so many of these cases, every theory I've heard, something doesn't line up. You know what I mean?
Agreed. Now, there was a tie-in that they had in where they tried to tie Steve Kocher's case with the disappearance of another case that happened a week before his.
Mm-hmm.
Susan Powell.
Yep.
If you're familiar with the story. So it was a week before Stephen Kocher had disappeared. She had went missing. And she had went missing from a suburb from Salt Lake. And it was initially suspected that her husband had murdered her on the assumption that she had been having an affair. So he was deeply looked into, questioned, but never arrested or charged or anything.
Yeah.
And he ended up taking his life in 2012.
Yep.
And so after that, when this came up, when Stephen Kocher's case became out in the public and it being so close, I mean, because this was in 2009, of course. So it was, his case was a week after, because, Joshua, her husband, had assumed that she'd been having an affair. He and her family basically, assumed that it was Stephen whom she had been having the affair with. I'm not sure why that was determined, because it was also said that they had been having an affair and then had eloped.
Yeah.
And then framed, basically trying to frame Joshua for murder. But there was never any actual evidence of them knowing each other. I mean, nothing they were able to find, records, call records, anything like that.
Yeah. But it was pushed so hard by the family that that the police really did look into it and check their call logs and
right
to see if there was anything in common between the two of them, and they never found anything.
It just seems like so convenient. They're like, oh, another guy disappeared, they have to have been together.
I mean, I think if you're familiar with the Susan Powell case, which it got way more publicity.
It became a high profile case.
Yeah. There was it went national news. There mm-hmm. was a Dateline, multiple Dateline episodes about it. There was Nancy Grace did a whole thing on it. Like it was a big case. But personally, I think her husband killed her. It makes perfect. I mean, all the police who were investigating it were pushing super hard to try it as a nobody homicide.
Mm-hmm.
And the DA just wouldn't do it. The DA had never done a nobody homicide before, and they just wouldn't pull the trigger on it. But all the circumstantial evidence lines up. It really does.
Yeah.
But the guy, the husband, his family said that the reason that he committed suicide in 2012, right?
Yeah, it was in 2012.
Yeah. So his family believes the reason he did that was because after it got super publicized, literally everyone who knew him were convinced that he had done it.
He was, right.
And he was completely ostracized, and they think that's what led to his suicide.
I mean, there's a very, very good chance it was him.
Yeah.
Yeah. It seems... Like, what better way to try and take the target off of his head than to throw
exactly.
it on somebody else that just happened to be in the area?
And someone who can't be held accountable either.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because he's missing, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how it always seemed to me. And that's why when you said you were covering this, I knew I had heard that name before. And then when I saw that there was a connection with the Susan Powell, then it all, came right. back.
Mm-hmm.
But I never really looked into this one before. I just knew it as that missing guy who the husband tried to push it off on.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what I think yet 100% about this case and what to kind of make or how to make sense of it, but I definitely don't believe in the ties with Susan Powell at all.
Same. I think agreed.
We can agree to rule that out. So there was some new information. So basically, I mean, this case, after numerous searches and things like that, it went cold. Obviously, I mean, there's no more information, nothing else that they could determine. They had a couple GPS locations, and I mean, they had nothing else.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they opened up a couple times looking into it. In 2015, there was a new theory that came out. So they investigated again, found no new information or whatever else. So by 2020, they finally released information to the public, and people started diving into it. And so that's what we're gonna talk about next. This is
I want to talk about like some web sleuths and shit.
This is where I start to kind of put together like my own idea, maybe, you know, possibly.
Okay.
So
yeah, I'm excited.
It was stated that Stephen had worked out like this agreement with his landlord. He had lost his job. He was behind on his rent. His landlord basically, said, that's fine. I'll work with you. I know you're good for it. So that was what we understood earlier on.
Right.
Well, it turned out he was over $1,500 behind on his rent. And it turned out that right before Stephen went missing, his landlord, by the name of Brett Bishop was his name. He had reached out to Stephen's dad trying to track down this money.
Okay.
And Stephen
was pretty aggressive.
Right. Yeah. So Stephen also had a roommate at the time named Jordan. Jordan stated that he was, he had decided he was going to move out, because Stephen couldn't keep up on his end of the rent. But it turned out that Jordan and the landlord actually had a few altercations as well. And the landlord basically accused him of stealing from him. And like, there was this whole big ordeal. And so like tried to play it off like he was moving out because, Stephen couldn't pay his rent, when it was actually, he had a lot of problems with the landlord, and I think it was escalating into something that he was trying to get away from.
Right. So like stealing from him as in not paying the rent, or actually like stealing from him?
See, that's what I'm not 100% sure on.
Yeah. Okay.
Cause I guess it could be either one, right? Especially right. With how far, behind on rent.
Yeah,
I mean, $1,500 is pretty significant amount. I mean, if he was willing to work with him, then great. But
yeah, I mean,
for him to seem like to be reaching out to his dad, that doesn't seem like that's the case.
2009. This is like a Salt Lake City suburb, right? St. George.
St. George was in. Yeah. It's
yeah.
I'm trying to find exactly where it is, but yeah, it's in Utah.
Yeah. $1,500, that's got, I mean, that's at least 3 months.
Yeah, it was $500 behind. A month. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That's, yeah, I mean, I could see 3 months behind, your landlord starts saying shit like, you're stealing from me by continuing to live here without paying. You know what I mean? Like,
but that's what he was telling Jordan.
Right.
Not Stephen, at least to our understanding, right?
Yeah.
So, like, it seemed like Jordan was trying to get up and out of something before. I don't know. Maybe he was trying to like pin it all on Stephen.
Yeah, could be.
So I mean, there's some of this that's coming about. So there starts to be this added bit from this landlord. We'll return to this in a little bit. Okay. Now, on the night of December 12th, which was the day before he went missing, the night of December 12th, a neighbor had seen Stephen at the house. He got there about 10 o'clock, and he was there for about 30 minutes before he left. He questioned him, asked where he was going, and Stephen says, I'm going to Las Vegas. And so we find that was in the original report. So if you go back and look at that, like, we see that. But it turns out that this is actually secondhand information.
Right.
It was the landlord that said that they had heard from the neighbor that they had seen Stephen at 10 o'clock to 10:30. But after they got the call records, Stephen was still at his house at 11 o'clock. He had made a call before he had left.
Yeah, that's weird.
But it was the landlord that actually stated that the neighbor said. So nobody actually talked to this neighbor. Huh. We don't even know if this neighbor actually exists who, quote unquote, had seen him, right?
Right.
So that's where, again, my mind, my eyes, everything is turning to this Brett guy. Like, seems a little sus at this point.
Yeah, I think I see where you're going here. Yeah.
And so
that's weird. Anytime that someone's giving like false or even unverifiable information to the police while they're investigating,
right,
they instantly become a suspect. Like,
that's
a problem.
So after that last call is made around 11 o'clock, no further calls until the next day. So the first call made the next day was at 8:52 a.m. and that actually pinged him in California. So he's in California. I forget it's like something heart or heart, whatever. I don't know. Some area in California.
Okay.
And so, which is a little weird.
Yeah.
And then the next call happens 2 hours later that shows him just south of Henderson in Nevada, which Henderson is where he had, you know, where he had went missing,
where he leaves the car.
Yeah. Right. So at 11:54 is when we get the security footage of him parking. 12 o'clock shows him walking across the street and out of view. So as we watch the reflection, as you can see, I mean, it's, you have to really watch for it. But as you watch the reflection, it shows him walking up to an address at 2260 Evening Light Street, which is the street that this is on.
Okay.
And the address is 2260. So now, according to the owner of the address, they had never saw this person, knew anything about him, whatever. But they they questioned the neighbor across the street, and it's a lady across the street, and she said that morning the people at 2260 had been acting strange. And a large moving truck had showed up at the house, moving a lot of boxes over the course of like 3 hours.
Okay.
And after that, she never saw the residence again.
Fuck me.
And so now, additionally, there was a white van that would normally sit there that after that day, she never saw again as well.
That's very odd.
We're going to continue that. But yeah, really, really odd.
I instantly wonder if there's any connection between the owners of that address and the landlord.
So there very well might be. So now on December 30th, 2009, so, you know, cut to a couple weeks later, detectives went to the address, to the 2260, and it was vacant. Completely vacant. Nobody, you know, nobody
they
answered.
They scrammed out.
Whatever. They returned on January 6th, still vacant, no response. They left a flyer with Steven's picture attached to the door. They returned later that evening. The flyer was gone. And so, but they tried answer, you know, tried banging on the door, trying whatever, no answer. Earlier that day, there had been a car in the driveway that was, after they ran the plates and everything, it was determined it was owned by Maria DiMaggio, which the owners were the DiMaggios. And later, they went back on January 8th, and there was a white van parked in the driveway.
Okay.
And the van was owned by Severio DiMaggio. Again, the owners of the address.
Right.
Still, no response. Nothing. You know, the house is vacant. The detective decided to leave his card that day, requesting basically contact upon their arrival, but never received any response. So on January 8th, so that same day, Angela DiMaggio, someone by the name of Angela DiMaggio, or DiMaggio, whatever.
Sure.
Contacts the police and tells them to search the desert area southwest of Anthem Highland and Democracy to search for Steven.
Okay.
So they go out, conduct a search in the area, and it's right outside of this housing addition.
Yeah.
They didn't find anything.
Okay.
No one's been able to determine who Angela DiMaggio is. No records of her in relation to the DiMaggio owners. Right.
Might have been a fake first name.
That's what I assume. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So on January 13th, the police finally contact Severio DiMaggio at their new address. They had moved in, like, they had this like 3-bedroom, 2-bath, big house. And they move into basically this one-bedroom condo or something.
Okay.
So he had never saw the flyer or the business card. They, you know, he told them they hadn't been living there. They had moved out, you know, but their son, lived in the back house. So it turns out there's actually a back house. It's, keep in mind, this back house is only 250 square foot area.
Yeah.
Like, really small.
It's like a garage conversion.
Right. So their son, Mark, was living back there.
Okay.
So they go, they request, you know, they tell him, you know, have Mark contact us. They go there, try to leave information for him.
Nothing.
Mark doesn't contact them until February 18th in 2010.
Okay.
And so when he finally contacts, they meet with them. They showed him pictures of Steven, and he basically said, you know, I can't say that I've seen him. Right. But after they start asking questions about him, he becomes really nervous, really antsy. He's completely fine. All the other questions that they ask, and they make those, they're like profiling him basically. Every time they bring up Steven or show him the picture, he gets really just, you're really like just nervous. And yeah, I mean, you can tell, right? You can tell something. So they knew something was up. And so he basically proceeded to tell the police that he had moved out of the back house, but was moving back to it. So he hadn't been there either, apparently. Okay. But he wouldn't tell them where he lived aside from that, you know, that he did stay in the back house sometimes, but he did live somewhere else, but he refused to tell them anything. He claimed that he was just, you know, he was a nervous guy. He didn't like people knowing of his personal business. He didn't have friends because most of them led drug lifestyles, and he didn't like that. He claimed to, for his work, claimed to do research for safety devices for buses, like school buses. And instead of providing them with an address, they'd provide them with a P.O. box. That they also found was very, very shady.
Yeah. I mean, he wouldn't be the first person to get nervous around cops.
Right.
Right.
I mean, obviously, yeah.
And definitely not the first person to not answer the door when cops come banging on it.
Right.
But yeah, it's definitely weird. I really want the landlord. That seems like a volatile situation that could have led to something violent. You know right. What I mean?
We're going to return to the landlord here in a minute.
Okay.
All this is weird. And all this kind of plays into this. Where does this go? Because there's so many like branches to this whole story that just seem extremely sus. Yep. It's 100%. So it turned out after they did some digging that Mark actually owned four properties, and I'm probably going to butcher this. I think it's Pahrump, Nevada.
Jesus, and, who is this kid?
Right,
four properties.
So, but the police didn't look into them, and from my understanding, it was till 14 months later.
Okay.
And when they started to, they went to four different properties, started talking to the neighbors, and one of the neighbors of one of the properties claimed to recognize a picture of Steven.
Really?
Stating that she had seen him at this house.
Okay.
So they did more digging into Mark DiMaggio, and it turned out that he had a history of drug use and violence and running. Like fleeing.
Yeah.
So, but that's kind of like, that's where we end our bit on Mark DiMaggio, because they didn't find anything.
Okay. So this guy really plays into the theory that Steven had kind of gotten mixed up in some shady shit.
Right.
So like if this guy, this Mark DiMaggio was, you know, he had a history of drug offenses and things like that. He even admits himself that all of his friends are.
Well, he doesn't have lifestyle. Friends because most right. people are lead a drug lifestyle.
Right. Which means all the people he knows lead a drug lifestyle.
Right.
So if Steven had gotten mixed up in that, ended up at this house to do some sort of deal with him and shit went sideways. You know what I mean? He could have ended up in a hole in the desert.
Yeah. Some people think that he left in another car with somebody from that address. And then maybe as naive and, you know, because I mean, this guy most likely has never dealt with anything like that before. Maybe he's taken advantage of, and then they do away with him in the end.
Yeah, he doesn't know that you never go to a second location.
Right, yeah. So let's cut to Brett Bishop, the landlord.
Yeah, I want to hear about this landlord.
So it turns out that he had quite the criminal history.
Okay.
So at back in, what was it, like 2005 or something, he started getting like, yeah, he getting tied to a lot of these criminal, this criminal activity and stuff. There was a raid that was done on his garage at one point, where a stolen $100,000 Porsche was found, along with basically 11 different license plates of varying areas. They tracked this back to a series of reported car thefts from different like lots and things like that, where these cars were essentially stolen and sold for stupid cheap.
Right.
So they think that this Porsche was one of those that he was trying to, you know, probably get rid of.
Defense. And
there was actually somebody came forward and said that they a guy that had had an airplane hangar or something tried to. Brett Bishop tried to talk them into letting him put the car in the hangar.
Yeah.
And the guy was like, no, you know, there's obviously something to this. Wouldn't allow him to do it.
Right.
Needless to say, they ended up finding more and more stuff in the garage. They found a lot of weapons, like literally a list of guns and rifles, along with a homemade silencer, which is extremely illegal.
Yes.
Drugs, of course. It was more marijuana. So it was, yeah. I mean, it was more like probably just a personal amount, but there was a lot of scales and he had a lot of like paraphernalia. So I mean, you know, most likely it probably dealt or sold at least to, you know, I mean, I guess that's basically the same thing in that regard.
And this was in 05?
But somewhere between 05 and 09, yeah.
Okay.
And so he was being charged on the marijuana and the silencer. And then it was also they found a series of pills, like pill bottles labeled to other people, of course, that he was also being charged with. Okay. So he basically eventually goes and surrenders himself with I'm pretty sure his like legal representative. And he had told the police that he had acquired the Porsche from a person named TJ. Tom Jones was the actual name.
Okay.
And interestingly enough, TJ also shared the same birthday as him. These are details that he provided, yes.
him and Tom Jones.
Right, yeah. So,
unusual.
Right. So you have this guy that clearly has this criminal history, knows how to make a homemade silencer.
Yeah.
And why he has that in the first place is,
yeah,
because he also had another gun that had a silencer attachment as well. And yeah, like, so, I mean, that makes like, I don't know. I can't help but to like, think maybe this landlord has something to do with this. Maybe all this was fabricated as like a thing to like put him.
I mean, let's be real. The only reason for someone to own a handgun with a silencer is to kill someone quietly.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's the only purpose it could possibly be for.
I mean, he's not out there target practice, you know, doing some target practice at like 3 in the morning. Right.
Yeah. He's definitely not hunting with a handgun with a silencer.
Yeah, it's obvious what this is for.
And this, I mean, this dude is maximum shady.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Like, it also sort of irks me that this dude has, like, drug and firearm charges, and he ends up being a landlord a couple years later.
Yeah.
Like, what?
So, I mean, I wouldn't put it past somebody like that. Once they start to get a little, you know, a little impatient, their patience is only going to wear so thin before they're ready to do something about it, right?
Yeah, before the threat of violence begins, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, and somebody like Steven might not have recognized the situation he was in because he hasn't spent time with people like this.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I can see him walking into a situation unaware.
Maybe hit the landlord and Jordan, the roommate's altercations, maybe.
Yeah.
Like, maybe he saw that. Maybe, you know, that's why he wanted to get out of there, but, you know, didn't want to. I don't know. You know, it's tough. Yeah. It's tough to say.
It's. Also, any crazy shit that went on between Jordan and the landlord could have spilled over.
Yeah.
Onto, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I could see somebody like Steven trying to step in and play mediator, you know, and that could go bad.
Yeah.
That could go really, really poorly for him.
So, I mean, it's tough because there's like almost two different like lanes we can go here. I want part of this to somehow both of them just be in cahoots.
Yeah.
Like Mark DiMaggio and Brett Bishop. Somehow, like, they just know each other and they're in cahoots. I can't put that out of the realm of possibility, I guess.
If the geography wasn't so big, right?
Right.
If there wasn't so much distance between them, like, it would be easy to say, like, well, they're both part of this, like, sort of shady underworld. You know what I mean? There's a chance that maybe, like, Steve owed him money. He owed the landlord a lot of money. So if I was writing the screenplay, right, then you could have a situation where the landlord is like, well, you know, take this bag, drive it to Vegas for me, and we'll call it even, right?
Yeah.
Something like that. And then he arrives, and maybe it's a setup.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe something else happens when he gets there and that, you know, leads to his untimely end. I don't know. They're both such shady characters.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I was thinking too. Maybe something was set up to where he did know. Because, I mean, Steven acts like, from the video, acts like he's walking. He knows where he's going.
Yeah.
Like, he knows where he's supposed to be.
Yeah.
I don't think he's going to a job interview in the middle of a cul-de-sac.
I don't think so either.
But
that's what's odd. That's what's odd when the family is like, well, he looked like he was just getting out and going to a job interview, but like, he parked in the middle of a fucking, like you said, a cul-de-sac. He's in a neighborhood.
If he had a job interview at 12 o'clock or so, or somewhere around there, mm-hmm. and he parks over here, he gets out and is walking at 12 o'clock. I mean, he has to be very close by.
Right.
Like, I don't see him parking his car over here and he's going to walk 3 blocks to the, you know, outside of this housing addition.
Or 10 or 12. I mean, who knows how big the, you know what I mean?
All we know is
it's a residential area, right?
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm just going to throw a last little bit here just for the sake of doing it, because it also doesn't add up. Okay. All right. So the last call that Steven had made from his phone was supposedly to his voicemail.
Right.
Now, instead, there's actually a report that shows the call was made to a redacted number. In the rest of this report, his phone number was clearly visible.
Yeah.
Any times, like, any voicemail, whatever, was always visible. But this particular call, they said to his voicemail, but the number was redacted, which seems a little weird.
That is weird.
So, it kind of suggested it's most likely a different number. Now, Rolf, which was Steven's father, he ended up passing away during the investigation, everything, I think, in 2011.
Yeah.
But Rolf tried to reach out to AT&T to get a list of the call records. You know, and because the police and everything had already gotten this information, had been reporting on it and stating this is exactly where, you know, and these are the locations for the GPS. According to AT&T, they had had an issue with their systems that day, and there was actually like a glitch that didn't show one or two locations. Okay. So there was no actual locations that were pinged, but yet the police, the reporters, everybody had been saying this for the last, I mean, you know, obviously 10, 15 the last years. Almost 15 years, right?
Yeah.
So that's also a little weird because there was never actually, because that especially the voicemail, so there was no location on that one, on that last one where the numbers redacted, but they claim it was the voicemail. AT&T says there was no way that they could provide any like geolocation or GPS location because they had a glitch in their system. But yet it was reported that he was near Russell Road and calling his voicemail. But again, the numbers redacted.
Yeah.
And AT&T has no actual location. But yet everything, all the reports show that it was.
It's weird that they kind of just seem to have just filled in a location for it.
Seems like a lot of this was kind of just filled in.
I could see us making assumptions about the fact that he called his voicemail based on like the length of the call or something like that, you know? But like where the fuck would they get near Russell Road?
I don't know.
Right?
And this is after the information was made public. So of course, till 2020, I mean, everybody was led to believe what they were told. So that adding to the rest of all this weird shadiness, like it makes it hard to really come up with like an appropriate idea or, you know, like
it's a bit of a clusterfuck.
It is. Right.
I don't know, man. I think the landlord is behind it.
I do too. Yeah. There's something about this landlord. He has some tie to this.
Yeah.
Especially making up the person, the neighbor that saw him and stuff.
Yeah.
Because, you know, obviously that had to have been the landlord just like spouting nonsense or trying to like coach the, you know, turn this into another direction. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so. I don't know. I could definitely see him like doing a setup to get rid of him.
Yep.
Obviously he was deep in the like criminal.
Oh yeah. I mean,
you know,
there was also community where the landlord, he worked with this like closed door pharmacy. So that's how he got all the pills. So for anybody that's not familiar with closed door pharmacies, they essentially, you can't just go there and get a prescription. They order it and they deliver it to places like hospitals or, into like, just like drug and alcohol centers, you know, things like that.
Supply rooms at
exactly
like council for counselors and
normally those drivers have to have some type of pharmaceutical license, but it turned out that Brett was the one driving and taking these medicines to these places, and then he would go and pick up like expired prescriptions and stuff like that. So it turns out that's most likely why he had so many of these, but I mean he had major like pain medicine and he had like hydrocodone and Percocet and Valium, a lot of different muscle relaxers and like
all the shit that ruined our population over the last 30 years.
Exactly.
He was involved in drugs, in illegal guns, in stolen cars. Tell me he didn't have hookups in Las Vegas.
I think somehow him and Mark DiMaggio were somehow intertwined in this. Somehow connected.
I think so too.
And we have our poor Stephen Kocher that just...
I know, just a sweet little LDS buddy. He's an ex-missionary.
Yeah.
Just this like little sweetheart of a dude. He got mixed up in all this shit. I think that's exactly what happened.
Maybe he was under the impression that he was going to get some work from like this person. Maybe, you know, and like maybe they were meeting at his home or something because it was like a startup. We could make all kinds of random guesses, but that's what I think.
The thing is, there's a chance that Steven even knew that it was that what he was going to be doing was a little shady.
There is a chance for sure.
Yeah, like he. Everyone agrees that he was sort of desperate at this time in his life, right? So maybe he did go for it and try to get involved to make some money even. But I think he was probably in over his head.
It's unfortunate. It's unfortunate. Like these types of stories are they're tough. They're tough. But
I'm excited.
I was going to say, I'm looking forward to seeing what we can find out. Maybe, you know, see what answers we can uncover when we do the next Camp Divination.
Agreed. I'm looking forward to seeing what Carly can do with this.
For sure. Yep.
I wonder if we can force her to give us a straight answer on whether he's still alive or not.
I don't know, but we're going to try.
Yeah, we're definitely going to try.
Awesome. Well, I really like these because they're just kind of fun to just come up with ideas and, you know, kind of determine our own solutions, or, you know, even just kind of guess what happened here. But I think that's going to have to do it for this week's episode. The disappearance of Stephen Kocher.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. From the bottom of our weird, possibly alien, maybe ghostly, probably cryptid hearts for listening. We absolutely love having the chance to discuss all these wild creatures and events every week, and it's your continued attention that allows us to carry on.
We want to get to know each and every one of you, so please come and check us out on all the socials. At campfire.tales.podcast on Instagram and Facebook, at campfire.totsau on Twitter, and you can also visit our website at campfirepodcastnetwork.com. If you love the show, please rate and review it. It's what truly helps us continue bringing your weekly dose of the strange and unsettling.
And a special thanks to Greg Martin at Reverent Music on Instagram for his contributions to the beautiful music that you hear every week under the debrief. You can find more of his tunes at reverbnation.com/reverent. It's fantastic, fantastic stuff. Go give that a listen.
And that's it. Until next time.
I'm Ryan.
I'm Jordan.
And remember, campers,
stay weird.
And trust in the unknown.